Hi, M. Gibbonize here. This episode of Cloak & Dagger contains some mature content involving the sexual exploitation of minors. So if you have kids with you, or anyone else who may be sensitive to this type of content, I just want to give you a heads up prior to listening. This is Cloak & Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Benias. This podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com. In the summer of 2022, I remember hearing about this story from Edmonton, that's in Canada, about this 13-year-old girl who went missing. Fortunately, they found her a week later in Oregon, that's not in Canada. She was picked up by a 41-year-old man one day outside of her junior high school, and somehow managed to cross the border with him. Police say she made contact with this guy via social media and a popular video game app. He befriended her, and while the details of all this are sketchy, he managed to get her all the way to Oregon before the FBI tracked them down. The crazy thing about all this is that kids get targeted all the time. In Canada alone, the Canadian Centre for Child Protection says that their cyber tip platform has seen an 88% spike in reports of child sexual exploitation since 2020, averaging at about 155 reports per month. The wild thing about this case in Edmonton was that the predator pretended to be a young man, a kid, and he essentially groomed this young girl to believe that he was like her, and he convinced her to meet, and she did. These predators, they use online video games and social media apps. Listen, I have kids, and they play video games, and this stuff literally freaks me out. But I'm also a member of the OSINT community, and I know some folks out there fighting against these predators. Folks like my buddy Griffin.
My name is Griffin Glynn, and I am the Chief Investigations Officer at the National Child Protection Task Force. I've been doing investigative work professionally for over 20 years now. I spent the first 20 years of my professional life working for a U.S.-based company, very big company, doing organized crime investigations for them. Loved my job, had an absolute blast doing it. Somewhere along the way, I started to realize that I could find information online that would make my investigations move quicker, maybe uncover pieces of information about a criminal network or, you know, where somebody is that we didn't have through other means. And I just kind of gravitated towards it naturally. Did it for a number of years, and then found out it was called OSINT.
So Griffin began to dive deeper into the OSINT world. He took some courses, started meeting other OSINTers, bought a bunch of books, and like many people in this world, just kind of taught himself.
And that's how I got into OSINT. Several years ago, I started working with the National Child Protection Task Force as a volunteer. And through my work there, I helped to identify victims, suspects, work on cases of child exploitation, child sexual abuse material, missing persons. We primarily work on missing, exploited, and trafficked children at the core of what we do. But we also do other types of work to support law enforcement in cases where vulnerable people are being harmed in some way. My work there, I also do a lot of training, for law enforcement specifically about open source intelligence and kind of how to supplement what they already know how to do as police officers with what's available online. Try to help direct them to new sources of information that maybe can help move their case faster or find that piece of information they need.
The National Child Protection Task Force is a nonprofit organization that works with law enforcement to provide training and support. It's mostly made up of volunteers, and they utilize their skills to track down child predators and locate missing and trafficked kids. They're very much the good guys here.
a friend of mine called me one day and he said, hey, there's this group down in Arkansas and they're having a conference next week. And they do all that crazy stuff that you do where they find people online and things, but they do it for kids, for missing kids. And he said, I thought it'd be something you were interested in. So I just wanted to point it out to you. So I said, all right, I'll sign up and take a look at it. So I intended to put the conference on one monitor of my computer while I worked the rest of the week. And I put it up there. And within the first half hour, I was just completely hooked. And I couldn't believe that there was this group of people out there doing things and utilizing skills and tools and things that I knew how to do very well for the purpose of helping children and finding missing people. And it was just like this mind-blowing moment for me where I realized, oh my gosh, I could be using my skills to do something like this. So I reached out afterwards to the CEO and I said, hey, you know, I want to introduce myself. This is my background. This is what I do. I love the conference. And if there's ever a way for me to be able to help out with the task force, I would be honored to help out. And so we got onto a call and talked and he said, you know, if you want to volunteer, you know, this is several years back now. So the nonprofit was all volunteers at that time. Now we have a number of employees, including myself. But he gave me a chance and I got in the door, and as soon as I worked the very first case, I knew that that was all I wanted to do. So nights, weekends, you know, when I was probably at times supposed to be working on other stuff, I was trying to find missing kids or solve these types of investigations. And then I really started investing in growing my skills because I felt like the work I was doing was making a real difference.
I can imagine. I mean, this work is some of the most noble work anyone can do. This is OSINT being used for good, helping kids who get trapped in situations with really, really bad people, and being able to track them down and bring those bad people to justice, it's really rewarding.
Any case involving a child who's being exploited is really, those are the most rewarding cases personally, because when you get that result, you know that oftentimes a child is rescued from a situation where they may not have even known that anybody was looking for them. For me, that kind of feeling is something that you don't get anywhere else. We have a number of cases that we work on that involve using clues within imagery to find a person or location. It's a process called geolocation. And there's several other subsets of things happening there. We might be, doing object recognition and other things. Those cases can take sometimes months and hundreds of hours. And when you do those cases, and 99% of the timeline of the case is just research and boredom and banging your head against the desk and not getting anywhere and not finding the place. And then that last 1% is where, oh my gosh, we've got this one cracked. We know where it is, we know who it is, and it's just grab as much information as you can, as fast as you can, and get that over into the hands of people that can do something with it. Those moments are the thing that keeps you going through that next one that's going to take you 6 months of it. And those cases are not our primary work. We do many missing and exploited children cases. Probably 80% of our casework is like that. So these represent a small subset of it, but they're so challenging and so time consuming and so impossible seeming when you are on the front end of it. But I'll tell you what, when you get to the end and you find the place or the person and you all that research pays off, it lets you know that, you know, you can do this again.
What are the cases that are like the most heartbreaking that you're just like, it's not worth it. Screw this. I quit.
So when you're talking about, people who prey on children, for example. For me personally, I have a very hard time. I have a hard time processing the way that people think, the people that commit those types of crimes. And depending on the type of work that you're doing, you may be in places where they communicate with each other. You may be working with case evidence that can kind of clue you into the things that they've done in detail. We don't work with any CSAM imagery or anything like that. Everything that we do for cases like that is either text-based or would be sanitized imagery and things like that. But even the text that can accompany case evidence like that can be incredibly damaging to read. And it's really difficult for me. Everybody kind of has their own personal boundary as far as how far they can go with what they're comfortable with. And of course, within our work and within our task force, we respect everyone's personal boundary wherever it is. I make no judgments about what people can and can't stomach in this line of work. But for me personally, reading those things, especially from a firsthand point of view of someone who is the perpetrator in those cases, that's the moment where I really go, gosh, can I do this?
Of course, and this has been a big topic in the intelligence and OSINT community in recent years. It's called vicarious trauma. It's basically emotional residue that comes from hearing about or seeing other people's pain and fear. A lot of OSINTers see imagery or video or read and hear testimony of some pretty horrible things, and these things tend to stick with you. They kind of needle into your brain, and they just haunt your thoughts sometimes. The more of this horrible stuff you engage with, the more of these horrible ghosts just sort of roam around your mind, and then they just randomly say boo at 2 p.m. on some idle Thursday while you're sitting in some coffee shop. That video you saw, or that photograph, or that sound clip.
Then I think about the child that's on the other side of that investigation and what their life is like and what it could be like if this person was captured, or, you know, if that abuse was stopped. And that helps me push through. And, it, you know, obviously not to the detriment of myself or anyone else. We take very good care of ourselves. Mental health wise, it's a paramount topic within our organization and within the space itself. But I can tell you that those days can be pretty tough.
Your mental health matters. Tons of people in this world burn out hard because of vicarious trauma. So make sure you take care of yourself. Okay, sorry, just had to put that in there. Back to Griffin.
Let me just, I guess, frame this up by saying the bulk of the work that I do involves using open source intelligence to try and either make an identification, find someone's online presence, gather up intelligence that can be leveraged by law enforcement. And that could be identifying that they have accounts with certain big data companies because those companies are going to have information that the officers may want. And when you're investigating cases that involve children, especially, they don't have the same information presence that an adult has. You know, if you're in law enforcement and you're looking for me, who is, you know, slightly into his middle ages, we'll say, there's databases out there that you can query that are going to have address, history, utilities that I've had, phone numbers, email addresses, all that things. Those things are readily available. When you're talking about a missing 15-year-old child, they don't have that kind of presence. You can't just query a database and get all those selectors that you would want to work with. So a lot of what I do is try to uncover those things so that we can connect those accounts, lead the police to the right places to submit subpoenas and things like that. And, you know, I think about a case like we had one here some time ago where a girl went missing in the middle of the night from her family home. And she was 16 years old. Next morning, the family realized that the girl was not in bed. She wasn't at home. They called the police. Police immediately came out and conducted all the preliminary investigative work that they would normally do. Took a look and saw that she had taken some personal items with her, clothing and jewelry and some things like that, but not the electronic devices. So indications there that she was, you know, possibly running away. They didn't have any other information to go on as far as who she was with or what she was doing.
Okay, so it's the middle of the night and this 16-year-old girl grabs her bag, loads up some clothes, some jewelry, some other personal items, and walks out the house, and she's gone. Now, The weird thing is that she's left her smartphone, which, you know, I mean, she's 16. That's kind of strange. Griffin, though, says that's just part of the plan.
Well, I'll tell you, this is the sad reality of child exploitation crimes, is that the offenders are getting, I don't want to say smarter because it gives them, positive credit here, but they will tell young folks that they are exploiting and grooming to do things that they know will cause people to maybe not look as hard for them. So, hey, leave a note for your family that says, you know, I want some time for myself and I've decided to run away, because they know that that's going to be treated differently in a lot of cases than the child who disappears after school one day, or, runs away with an adult, right? So your 15-year-old daughter runs away with a 40-year-old man. A lot of people are going to be looking for that 40-year-old man, that 15-year-old girl. The girl leaves a note and says, you know, I hate living here and I'm going to, you know, I'm going off on my own. Don't try to find me. Those cases don't get the same kind of attention. That is probably not going to show up front page news like the first example would.
That is crazy to me. These predators basically tell the kids to leave their phones, write a note that puts people off the trail. It's basically a form of tradecraft to manipulate the kids and the parents and law enforcement.
There are many levels to that that tradecraft, and it's not only is it something that's happening all the time, it's documented. They share those things with each other in certain places, and they give each other tips and considerations for how to not get caught or how to find children. Nowadays in the world of connectivity that we have with cell phones and online gaming and things for kids, think about how accessible they are by predators. And those predators are specifically doing things like directing them to a better place for them to talk, right? An app that mom and dad don't recognize, or a place that's going to be more anonymous for them. There's definitely thought process there.
This is really messed up, but we'll get to that later. So we have a missing 16-year-old girl who disappears in the middle of the night. The police are investigating. She doesn't have her phone, so they can't track her that way. She's basically gone totally dark.
They knew that she had gone out and probably gotten picked up by someone in the middle of the night, and she didn't have her electronic devices with her. So the normal course of business in those cases is going to involve things like subpoenas to the places where you would find people's data, right? Your Apple, your Snapchat, your Facebook, things like that. The problem is, in that case, those devices were left behind and those accounts were left behind and they weren't being accessed. So the police had done all of the things that they would normally do and done it all the right way, but didn't come up with any answers. And what they did come up with through a forensic analysis of a game system that she was using is the user account of someone she was communicating with in the days prior to her disappearance. And that person obviously is somebody that you would want to identify and talk to in an investigation like this. The trouble was, when they got with the data company that had that particular gaming account, the information that came back was an email address and a general area, and it wasn't particularly helpful to them. So they reached out for assistance with trying to figure out who was on the other side of that email.
So the police call up the National Child Protection Task Force, and Griffin takes the case. They have one lead. The missing girl was a gamer, and she had a gaming system and an online account attached to that system. And when the police accessed the chat transcripts attached to that account, they found this other user who she was talking to a lot.
And I took the username portion of that email, and I ran it through a number of tools and searched around for it online, and eventually identified someone using that username on a particular site that allowed them to connect to other people. They were only connected to a handful of other people, but they were connected to a couple that had the same last name as what their display name was. So thinking that was probably a family network, I went to other social media searches and discovered that same family network in another more common social media that's going to have a lot more information. And put those pieces together, identified who those people were, and looked through the accounts of what I believed was the person connected to that gaming account, and actually found the same profile photo being used in the social media of that person that was also used in the gaming accounts.
A hit. Okay, so Griffin runs the username part of the email, the stuff before the at sign, and he gets a hit on a social media site, which can't be named due to legal reasons, and that connects the target to a bunch of other people with the same name. He then runs those names through a larger social media network. It's a big one, you can probably figure it out, and bam, there it is. He figures it out. He figures out who this missing 16-year-old girl was talking to online literally hours before she disappeared.
So making that sort of potential connection there, right? We're talking about OSINT, so nothing is a smoking gun per se. But in this case, we had a pretty good indication that this might be the person behind that account. So at that point, law enforcement had gone and tracked him down. They interviewed him. He had nothing to do with the girl disappearing at all.
Damn, so close. So this guy she was talking to was not involved directly.
But what he did have was the new account that she was using on a platform that collects location information. And she wanted to remain in contact with him after she disappeared. And so that was being used on a new device, all new selectors and things for this girl. Most likely given to her by the person that she was with, 28 hours away from home, all the way on the other side of the country from where she lived.
So this gamer buddy of hers was still in touch with her, and they were connected via another popular social media app. So the police end up sending a subpoena to this social media service, and they respond, sending the police everything about the device, where she posted from, everything.
They were able to use that location information and go rescue her from the situation she was in. Obviously, it was not a good situation, but otherwise, the traditional methods had not worked, and they needed a new kind of way to be able to find something to look for this girl with, and OSINT opened that door for them.
So they found her, and the guy who picked her up. But at this point, to protect the privacy of the child, Griffin doesn't know much more.
That information I don't have. I can make some assumptions based on what we were told. You know, she had been groomed to go away with this person. There was likely, sexual abuse happening there. But I don't have the specifics of what happened with that. Really our portion of the work is usually get them the data that they need to get to the person, the victim, the child. The prosecution stuff takes a long time afterwards, goes through all the different stages of that over the course of sometimes years. And we oftentimes don't have the result. And honestly, I'm on to the next thing as soon as I package that up and send it off. So based on the fact that this child was such an avid gamer and we knew that they were using their gaming console to communicate with other people, it's very likely that they met the person that exploited them, that potentially trafficked them, through a video game experience. And just the general reality of those games is that if there is a communication feature built in, there are going to be predators that are looking for children. That's just the nature of how they work and what they do. The sad reality is kids very, very young nowadays get access to these games that seem harmless to parents, that maybe they don't understand the potential dangers. And they give them unfettered access, or they let them go privately into their room and play their games on their, on their phone or on their computer and things like that without ever realizing that they're being accessed by the outside world, by sometimes adults in the outside world who might look to harm them or groom them and lure them away from their families.
So they go after the kids where the kids themselves wouldn't think adults hang out. Like, if someone sends a kid a message, that child isn't going to sit there and think, oh, this is probably an adult.
And they get, it's really sad. I mean, they find these children who, first of all, as a teenager, you're not mentally fully developed. You might have low self-esteem, other issues, and they find those vulnerable people, those vulnerable kids, and they exploit that vulnerability, and they find ways to groom them. And sometimes over the course of a very long period of time, they groom them. Nowadays, you see lots of sextortion happening you know, where people are blackmailed. So a child is coerced or tricked in some way into sending a compromising photo of themselves. And then the person will, on the other end, will blackmail them in essence into creating more content, more material, send me photos this way, send me videos this way. And if you don't, I will tell your family. I have your parents' phone number here. I see that your dad works at XYZ company.
Whoa, yeah, this is the problem. At the top of this episode, Griffin said that his job tracking down child predators was super rewarding because he was able to use his talents with OSINT to make a real difference. That OSINT is a force for good. But with any tool, there is always a way to cause harm.
So they're using their own open source intelligence research to find ways to blackmail these kids.
I mean, this is literal human intelligence level stuff that these predators are using. They find a target and they begin to assess whether they're viable. In the intelligence world, HUMINT uses this acronym, MICE, or MICE. It stands for money, ideology, coercion, and ego. Basically, when spies try to turn their targets into assets so they can commit espionage or treason and give up sensitive information, that potential asset needs some kind of oomph to turn them, right? So maybe they need money to pay off some serious debt so the intelligence officer can use that pressure to convince them to turn. Or maybe they hate their bosses where they work, so the officer can use that and convince them that by turning, it's like they get to give their boss the middle finger and say, screw you, man, and they get that feeling of satisfaction. Sometimes you need to use coercion. You need to blackmail them or lie to them. But before you can apply mice to a target, you need to know those pressure points. These child predators, they do exactly that. They converse with these kids, find out what life is like at home, what their parents do, what their relationships are like, and they do it all under a false persona.
It's definitely a game of cat and mouse. These people, the predators in child exploitation cases, oftentimes are actively taking countermeasures to avoid being identified, to avoid being connected to things that have their real identity in them. And really what I spend a lot of time focusing on is finding that one mistake, finding that one time in the past where they referenced something, maybe they changed a username from something that they had used elsewhere. Perhaps they recycled a password that they've used in another place that I can locate in a data breach. Maybe they use the same profile image in different places. There's any number of ways that they can make a mistake. Granted, the best of the best ones, they might not make mistakes, or they might not have made a mistake in many, many years. And you have to go far back in time. I worked on a case at one point where we had a current username and we didn't have really anything based off of that username to work on.
Okay, let's get into this. We have a username.
So we were clued into a person on the dark web, a persona who was operating in an environment where child sexual abuse material was present. And they were likely somebody that was producing that material themselves. And our intention was to try and see if we could identify this person.
A username of a target who was not only sharing child sexual abuse material, but was likely also creating it. And just for clarity, sometimes this content is referred to as CSAM.
Now, we don't work with the actual abuse imagery. We work with the text that accompanies it. So you're talking about chats and usernames and things like that. And in this case, after running through all of the normal procedures that we would on a username and trying to find it elsewhere in the world, trying to find it in breach data on other social sites and things like that, we really came up empty-handed.
So a quick glossary check here. Breach data. When a data breach occurs, like a bank's servers get hacked and the hackers leak all the client's personal data online, like usernames, addresses, phone numbers, passwords, all that stuff is breach data. So you can find sites that compile known breaches. Some are just websites and some are tools you have to download and some are pay services, but they are out there and they're pretty easy to find. Anyway, all that data is just put into searchable databases. You can type in a username or an email address or a phone number or even just a name and it will go through and find all instances of that username or any piece of information across thousands and thousands of known data breaches. There you go. Simple. Okay, back into it.
I was able to there's a number of dark web scraper tools out there that allow you to, you know, search content on the dark web and so on. I was able to find this user several years in the past.
Okay, so Griffin gets a whole bunch of results from the scraper tool, hundreds of pages, and he starts going through each one, and this led him to a specific forum where sexual exploitation content is frequently shared, and the scraper returned hundreds of posts made by the target username. So he starts to go through the posts, one by one. And then
I was able to find this user several years in the past, transitioning from a prior username to their current username, and they made reference to that transition happening.
Bingo! The target had a previous username, so now Griffin had another clue.
And someone had said, weren't you XYZ person before? Yes, that's me. Because in this world, they need to have a little bit of credibility with their peers. Because those people are very suspicious of who's around them and who they're communicating with. And this person was saying, yeah, that's me. You remember me from before.
So Griffin has a solid lead, but there was more. The old username that the target used was also connected to a password. So, and this is seriously messed up, but in the child sexual exploitation material world, credibility is key, and the only way to earn that credibility is to share CSAM content, because once you share it, you've broken the law, and that basically proves you're not law enforcement and that you can be trusted.
You know, here's a link to this media that I want to share with people, and here's my password. So that's a very common thing in those CSAM forums, is in order to achieve a status in those places, if you're a provider of content to other people, you know, if you're involved in trading and giving stuff to people or whatever, then you achieve a little bit of social status kind of in that.
So the target Griffin was after made a bunch of posts under a previous username and shared a password publicly to the content so others could view it.
And as the person transitioned their username identity to a new username, they didn't transition that password. And so in their posts, in doing my research and going way, way back in time, turning over hundreds and hundreds of rocks, I was able to find the time that they used the same password, in their files and mentioned sharing these same files as they transitioned the username.
Basically, Griffin confirmed that these two usernames belonged to the same person. The two usernames linked to a repository of CSAM files, and the password was the same.
So this person must have realized that they wanted to be a little bit safer and changed their username to something that they'd never used before that didn't connect to anything else. But they still needed to sort of have that credibility with that group of people. And so, yeah, they had to out themselves as transitioning their username in order to maintain the credibility that they had already established.
And while their current username was a dead end, that old username, well...
So using that prior username, I was able to go back, and that username was connected to a great deal of information. There were email accounts associated with that username. There was social presence in a lot of different places, breached passwords. So, you know, using the tools that we always use, I was able to build out a profile on who the potential person was connected to that username previously. And that stuff is packaged up and given to law enforcement to help their efforts on their side to be able to try and make an actual case against this person.
And did they get the guy?
Yes, it was the person.
Yes.
Because it's still ongoing, I can't say a lot more details about. But yes, it was the person. They are actively working on, unraveling the web of this person's life, right? Because when you open the door on these cases and you get someone, the amount of information that you can find is unbelievable. These people operate for years often before they get caught or identified or reported on. The sad reality is that the rate of children disclosing abuse is very low, lower than you would think. And unfortunately, as an adult, we look at that and we think, well, of course, it would get reported. The children would report that, but we're looking through the lens of an adult, right? A fully formed and developed person who's had life experience, and children are not like that. So, yeah, these folks take advantage of that, and these people can operate sometimes with impunity for many years.
This is a heartbreaking situation. All those survivors out there who carry this trauma with them, and all those kids who are still out there today that are the targets of this predatory community, and the fact that this community, well, they're getting better and better at hiding. The internet has a lot of dark corners, and every passing year, as tools to anonymize and obfuscate become more prevalent, they become cheaper and easier to use, it becomes much more difficult for investigators. So to counter that, the investigators themselves use new OSINT tools and skills to hunt. In this case, Griffin's target made a mistake, posting about this username transition, an error pretty much fueled by vanity and ego. It was enough for Griffin to break the case open. For investigators, it's often a game of finding that one misstep.
So early on in doing this kind of work, I was really motivated by catching the bad guy, you know, because that was the world I came from in my previous work doing organized crime investigations. It was all about catching the bad guy or, you know, bad person or unraveling the network and figuring out what they were doing. And honestly, what I found in having that mentality and doing this kind of work is a lot of frustration and disappointment. And because the reality is the more important aspect of these types of cases is the child. And so what I learned from more experienced people and people around me that were, you know, telling their own stories is that the people that have been able to do this for a long time and do this very successfully, they concentrate on the children. And when you concentrate on the children, it's about rescuing the victim. It's about helping that child have a better life. It's about taking someone from a place of horror and abuse and terrible things and giving them an opportunity to have a childhood and to, you know, break free of that kind of thing. And for me, that's very fulfilling. And you don't have the same kind of discouragement that you might have where you put a lot of effort into identifying the bad guy, and then the bad guy happens to be in a country where maybe they don't have well-developed laws about this kind of thing and nothing really happens to them. Or maybe the case eventually lacks the evidence to have some kind of prosecution, or, you know, some other thing happens that you don't get the result that you want, right? But when you make it about the child and you make it about helping that child get out of that situation, then that's where you get really the benefit and the ability to carry on.
Thank you to Griffin Glynn for coming on the show, and thank you to him and the National Child Protection Task Force for their hard work. Links to the task force and to Griffin's work are in the show notes. If you're interested in supporting this organization, the link to donate is on their website. If you live in Canada, make sure to check out the Canadian Centre for Child Protection. I'll put their link in the show notes too. For more tech, intelligence, and OSINT content, check out www.cloakanddagger.blog. Also, a big shout out to the fine folks who help keep Canada safe and power this podcast, Sapper Labs Group. You can find them at www.sapperlabs.com. This is Cloak and Dagger. I'm MJ Benias. Oh, and please make sure you rate and review the show. Share it with your friends. Bring it up at your next dinner party. Post it to your socials. It's all greatly appreciated. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here soon.